Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for dropping along tonight. David Day makes a welcome return. I think he was here talking about his previous book. I think it was last week, or it might have been the week before, but he's highly productive in terms of writing, and I'll introduce him very briefly. He's written widely on Australian history, and of course his Claiming a Continent, a New History of Australia, won the non-fiction prize at the 1998 South Australian Festival Awards for Literature. But of course he's spoken at the Institute on his biography of John Curtin and Ben Chifley, and those papers have been published, and both of those books have been very well reviewed and widely praised and have won awards. David Day is currently with the History Program at La Trobe University of Melbourne, and he's also a visiting professor at the University of Aberdeen. But tonight he's here on the occasion of the publication of Andrew Fisher, Prime Minister of Australia. And so we've titled tonight's talk, Andrew Fisher, Australian Prime Minister. David, thank you very much.
Thank you for all coming. I thought it would be an empty room today. I thought everyone would be home watching the news from America, as I was in an internet cafe earlier today. It's a pretty incredible time. It's an historic day for the world, with Obama as president. But it's also, this time is an historic time for Australia as well. It marks the centenary since Andrew Fisher first came to power. And he went on to become the first Labor Prime Minister ever elected in the world. So the first socialist Prime Minister in the world. If you Google, you know, first socialist Prime Minister, you'll get all sorts of alternatives, but I don't think Fisher comes up at all. But in fact he was. The other alternatives, I think, were a Norwegian Prime Minister in the 1920s, or Lenin, of course. But Fisher beat them by a decade or more. So Fisher then became, in 1910, the first Australian Prime Minister with a majority in both Houses of Parliament. He served for three separate terms, occupying the office of Prime Minister for longer than John Curtin, Ben Chifley, Gough Whitlam, or Paul Keating, and almost as long as Alfred Deakin, 4 years and 10 months. Yet despite all that, it's also historic today, because we've now finally got a biography of Andrew Fisher, and it's really anomalous, shocking really, that we've had to wait 100 years to get a biography of such an important Prime Minister. And it's not totally by neglect, it's partly because, tragically, three biographers died on the job before they finished. So this sort of gave an extra impetus when I took on the job myself. My health's not bad, but it was a 6-year job, and one was very conscious that perhaps this was a jinxed project. Well, a more balanced assessment of Fisher, I mean, the other problem is that he's had jaundiced assessments of him, and that has really skewed his reputation over the years. People have looked at Fisher through the views of his opponents, either Billy Hughes or Alfred Deakin, and the biographers of those two men have helped to give Fisher a reputation as a mediocre politician. Well, a more balanced assessment of Fisher was given by the Queensland historian Dennis Murphy, who had been planning to write a biography, but who did get around to writing the entry on Fisher for the ADB. and who described Fisher as one of the most successful Australian politicians, with a legacy of reforms and national development which lasted beyond the divisions that his successor Billy Hughes left in the Labor Party and in Australia. Well, as I said, Dennis Murphy was planning to write a biography of Fisher, but tragically died quite young at the age of 48, and my book has been dedicated to Dennis. Thankfully, he'd done an awful lot of research, both in Australia and overseas, and collected a lot of original material on Fisher, which he then donated to the University of Queensland Library. So that was an incredible help to me. So what I want to do today then is to assess some of Fisher's political achievements and explore the ways in which he used his position as Prime Minister, in particular to promote a greater sense of Australian nationhood and identity. Well, just briefly sketching out his life, he started as a coal miner at a very young age, and the ages differ in various accounts from 9 up till 13. I think it was probably more at the upper end of that age, maybe at 12 or 13, that he started working down a local coal mine near his village in Ayrshire, just south of Glasgow. He got involved in the trade unions. His grandfather and father before him had been coal miners, and got involved in some quite extended strikes in Ayrshire, which ended rather inconclusively. They went for about 10 weeks or so at great cost to the miners, with very little reward at the end of it. And for Fisher personally, he was blacklisted by the mine owners, so he found it quite difficult to get a job. And he was involved with Keir Hardie as well, who was the secretary of the Ayrshire Miners Union, and Fisher himself at the age of 17 was secretary of his local branch of that union. He was also involved in moves to extend the franchise in Britain to support Gladstone's move to extend adult franchise or manhood franchise in Britain, and chaired a big meeting in his village to support that, and in fact wrote to Gladstone to tell him what he'd done, and got a nice letter back of acknowledgement. Well, being blacklisted and finding it difficult to get on, he left Ayrshire at the age of 22 in 1885 and went with his young brother and a group of friends from Ayrshire out to Queensland. You think going out to Queensland, big open spaces, you get a job in the open air, but no, he got a job with an Ayrshire mine manager down a coal mine just near Hervey Bay. And there he might have remained. He bought a house in a town called Howard, and may well have remained there had he not been passed over for the job as a mine manager. He'd been put in charge of sinking a shaft, a new mine shaft, and then applied for a job as mine manager, which went to somebody who Fisher thought was lesser qualified. So Fisher threw up his hands and threw in his job and left for Gympie, which was a nearby gold mining town, much bigger town, with many of the features of the civilization that he was used to in Ayrshire. Lending libraries, cooperative societies, stronger trade unions, lots of churches, debating societies, chess clubs, all the sorts of things that he hankered for but which weren't there in the mainly male-dominated coal mining town of Howard. So Fisher very quickly got involved in the labour movement, and in 1893 was elected to the Queensland Parliament and was pretty much picked out as a future leader of the Labor Party, which was growing in power in Queensland, against the background, of course, of those very serious strikes that were going on in the shearing industry and also on the docks. However, he was accused, and Labor was accused at the subsequent election in 1996 of being anti-Catholic. 1896, what did I say?
1996.
Yes, 1896, yes. 100 years of political career and got thrown out so unfair. In 1896 he was thrown out because Labour and Fisher personally were accused of being anti-Catholic. Well, that was completely unfair, the accusation against Fisher, but nevertheless he was tossed out, and rather than simply going back to gold mining, he established a Labour newspaper in Gympie called the Gympie Truth. And imported Henry Boot, who would go on to become the leading, really, Labour journalist in Australia, and who had earlier been editor of a Bundaberg newspaper. So he brought him up to Gympie as editor of the newspaper. Gympie itself was a rather conservative place in Labour terms compared with a place like Chartered Towers in northern Queensland, and Fisher's paper reflected that. There was very little. There was, I think, one paragraph taken from Marx in all the issues of the paper that survive. There were instead sort of salacious short stories to try and get readers. There was also a page or two of mining intelligence, which were the reports from the mines, how much gold had been dug the previous week, because the miners needed to know how much their dividend was going to be, because they were also shareholders. They were both workers and shareholders. And Fisher himself owned about £150 worth of shares in local gold mines. Well, Fisher, unlike many of the Labour supporters in Queensland, was very much in support of federation. He put aside any reservations he had about the Constitution as being too conservative and limiting Labour in trying to institute its program, and spoke out widely in favour of federation, despite Henry Boot and the newspaper coming out against it. So Fisher's own newspaper took an opposite view to the view that Fisher took. And Fisher was already looking to get a seat in the new parliament. So he stood for the seat of Wide Bay in 1901 and served in the first Labour government, led by Chris Watson in 1904, served as custom minister. The government, though, only lasted for 4 months. The following year, Fisher was elected as deputy leader and in 1907 replaced Watson as leader. 2 years later, 100 years last week, I think it was, Fisher became Prime Minister as a result of the shifting allegiances within the Parliament. This was a time when there were three parties in the Parliament and nobody had a majority up until this stage. No Prime Minister enjoyed a majority in the Parliament. They relied on the support of the crossbenchers. So Fisher's main aim in power then as leader of a minority government was to try and stay in office until the following election, so that Labour could go to the people after 18 months or so, if he could manage to last that long, and go to the people as leader of a responsible administration. Well, Fisher's plans were dashed. This was a time when parliaments were often shut for 6 months or even as long as a year. The doors were shut, so you could stay in power so long as you could keep Parliament from meeting. So Fisher's plans were dashed, though, by the outbreak of the Dreadnought crisis in Britain in early 1909, which led people in New Zealand and in Australia to call for their separate countries to contribute a Dreadnought to the British Navy. So all the pro-imperial elements in Australia called for the Australian government to contribute £1 million to buy a dreadnought for Britain's navy. Well, Fisher had his own ideas about what the Australian navy should consist of, and it wasn't a dreadnought in the North Sea. What he wanted was these torpedo destroyers that the Japanese had used with great effect against the Russian navy just a few years before. And in early 1909, he ordered three of these torpedo destroyers from Britain as the first echelon of the Australian Navy. It was a navy that was designed not to roam the oceans, but to guard Australia's ports and shores. The only problem was that the Dreadnought issue led to a great popular upsurge against the Fisher government. There were huge meetings in Sydney and Melbourne and other capital cities and major towns calling for the government to back down and instead contribute a dreadnought to Britain. The issue gave Deakin his chance to team up with the Conservatives in the Parliament. Deakin at the time was leading a declining Liberal Party, and he amalgamated with the Conservatives, and when Parliament eventually met at the end of May 1909, voted a vote of no confidence against Fisher and forced Fisher to resign. Well, at the 1910 election, the following election, Fisher led the party to an historic win. It saw a single party control both houses of parliament for the first time, and Fisher, as I said, became the first socialist prime minister elected to power. And he set about with a will to enact Labor's platform. He wanted, he said, to make Australians the happiest and most prosperous people in the world. And the following year saw more legislation passed than in any previous period. Fisher's political achievements included the following, and that many of them are with us still today. If you try and think of the legacy of Alfred Deakin, it's very hard to think of a single thing that is still with us today. But there's a huge number of things that Fisher introduced that are still with us today. There was old age pensions, there was a baby bonus, maternity allowances to help women at the most important time of their life when they'd given birth to try and ensure that a doctor attended the birth to try and cut down the terrible infant mortality rate. There was encouragement of migration, which was really quite a radical move. You know, we think of Labor and migration in terms of Arthur Calwell, but it was in fact Fisher who put aside the misgivings that the Labor Party had about migrants coming in and taking Australian jobs. He realised that Australia, with a population the size of London, holding a continent the size of Europe, was untenable, and that it needed to build up its population and do so quickly. So he set aside Labor's misgivings about migration and encouraged migration in that important pre-war period. In another move to try and encourage an increase in population, he introduced a land tax to break up the large estates. Those estates that squatters were sitting on from the early 19th century and not developing. So he put a tax on undeveloped land to try and get them to sell off these blocks of land so that migrants could come in and set up small farms. They wouldn't be taking jobs from existing workers. They would be creating new jobs and new settlements in the interior of Australia. He also brought in workers' compensation for Commonwealth employees. This was an issue, of course, that was very close to his heart as a miner, a man who'd seen his own father die of, or suffer at least from black lung disease and later die from it. He established the Australian Capital Territory and laid the foundation stone for Canberra and gave it its name so that now it's called Canberra rather than Shakespeare. Or as somebody suggested, Fisher. So really quite a brilliant choice of name. Also organised the takeover and development of the Northern Territory. This had been a continual problem for Australia, having this huge area of tropical Australia that had only a few thousand Europeans occupying it. Fisher not only took it over, you know, he planned the railway to Darwin, but of course it was never built, mainly because of the First World War, but also sent three of his closest associates, people who he felt he could trust to implement his policies, to live in Darwin and develop the land, to develop mining and to administer the territory. He established the Commonwealth Bank, which was done in the face of opposition from Hughes, who warned of opposition from the men of money. Hughes warned Fisher that Labor must go far, but not too far. He also introduced Australian currency, so that the money in your pocket now is printed by the Australian government, rather than by Westpac. He constructed the Transcontinental Railway, linking Adelaide and Perth, and had plans, as I said, to have a railway to Darwin and also an inland railway that is still waiting to be built between Adelaide and Brisbane. He established the Australian Navy and also the first echelon of the Australian Air Force. He introduced compulsory military training, and he also upheld much more vigorously than his predecessors White Australia, and organised the ending of the Pacific Islander involvement in the sugar industry. Well, Fisher wanted much more. He wanted to expand federal powers through amendments to the Constitution. He wanted power over trade and commerce, the sorts of powers that we now take for granted that the federal government has. He wanted power over trade and commerce so that his policy and Deakin's policy of new protection could be implemented after it had been disallowed by the High Court. And he wanted the ability to curb and even nationalise monopolies. Twice he went to the people with referendum proposals, but was defeated both times. The second time, he timed the referendum to coincide with the 1913 election, hoping that the tide for Labor would carry the referendum across the line. Instead, the anti-referendum vote meant that Labor narrowly lost the election while holding on to power in the Senate. Undaunted, though, he was determined to try again so that Labor could make its political aspirations a reality. He was convinced that Labor was in the ascendant, that it was the natural party of government, and how could it be otherwise when Labor was the party of the people while their opponents represented this minuscule section of Australian society, the so-called money power, as Labor liked to call it at the time. Well, as I mentioned, many of Fisher's policies were directed towards enhancing the effective occupation of the continent and were driven by an abiding fear of the Japanese invasion following the Japanese victory over Russia in 1905. Like many Australians, he was acutely conscious that they were recent arrivals in a lightly inhabited continent, and if they could not demonstrate to the world that they were making productive use of its land and resources, they would be vulnerable to a challenge to their occupation. Fisher was intent on creating the conditions that would boost Australia's population, both through natural increase in immigration and in boosting its ability to defend its own shores. Well, Australia was caught in the predicament of being part of an empire whose main rival, Germany, was in Europe, while Australia's feared enemy was in the North Pacific. Should they protect Britain in the hope that Britain would also protect Australia? Or should they concentrate on protecting Australia's own shores? And if the latter, how was it to be done with Australia's small population? Well, Fisher could never devise an adequate solution to this dilemma, and neither could his successors. Well, despite Fisher's move in 1909 to establish an Australian-based navy, he became increasingly concerned to prepare Australia for a war in Europe. And this was particularly so after he went to London in 1911 for the Imperial Conference and was secretly informed that he should prepare Australia for a war that was expected to break out in Europe by 1915. Well, turning now to Fisher's encouragement of an Australian identity, apart from these practical measures that Fisher introduced to build up Australia's defences, he was also anxious to encourage a sense of Australian identity and nationhood. At the time of his greatest triumph in 1910, he told a meeting of the White Workers' Union, which was female clothing workers in Brisbane, that they should think of themselves as part of the nation, and he urged them to go out and cultivate a national spirit. He wanted Australians to think of themselves firstly as Australians rather than the inhabitants of a particular state, and he was highly critical of attempts by state governments to retain their pre-Federation status vis-a-vis Britain. It was a time when state premiers still saw themselves at least the equal of the prime minister in status. They would have premiers' conferences at which the prime minister might or might not be invited, according to the whim of the premiers. Well, of course, a sense of Australian identity had been developing ever since the arrival of the First Fleet. And it was given added impetus by Federation and the creation of a national government. But it took time for the federal government to assert its supremacy over the states and for a national identity to assert itself over state or imperial identities. Well, Fisher then helped to encourage national identity in several ways. By the creation of national institutions such as the Commonwealth Bank, the Navy, a national army, with all males required to undertake military training, the Transcontinental Railway, a national capital, and a capital on a grand scale, a capital that was meant to rival Washington, and all set safely, of course, behind the Great Dividing Range. He also did it by the construction of national edifices, the monumental buildings constructed for national institutions. And if you wander down Martin Place, of course, you can see them in the structures of the GPO and the Commonwealth Bank. And the most monumental of all, of course, Australia House in London, in which Fisher took a particular personal interest. He also did it by the encouragement of a national sensibility. And one of the things that I was most struck by in researching this was the contact that Fisher had with the artists of the Heidelberg School. In fact, his office in Melbourne at number 1 Collins Street was right next to the artist studios of Tom Roberts and Arthur Streeton. He used the services of perhaps his closest friend, the artist Hugh Patterson, to redesign the Australian coat of arms, which did away with the cross of St George that dominated the old design. Rather than replacing it with the Union Jack, as some wanted, the new coat of arms had the different emblems of the states on the shield, surmounted by the Commonwealth Star, and it replaced the motto "Advance Australia" with the simple word "Australia." He also embellished the design with sprays of wattle. Fisher stipulated that the coat of arms had to feature on the new Australian currency. It was going to be in the handbags and the wallets of most Australians and brandished in pubs and shops across the nation. In 1913, when he was returned to power, he replaced the former colonial stamps with an Australian stamp. Rather than the head of the king, the stamp featured a kangaroo on a map of white Australia, with the single word "Australia" emblazoned across the top. He also established an art advisory board and an historic memorials committee to encourage Australian artists to paint national scenes and portraits of historic figures and paintings of historic events. And the board, to show how important this was to Fisher, the board was chaired by Hugh Patterson, his closest friend. The secretary was Malcolm Shepherd, Fisher's own secretary, and also on the board was Senator Gregor McGregor, perhaps Fisher's closest political associate. So the board was entrusted with the decoration of Australia House. He also, under pressure from Patterson, imposed a tariff on imported European paintings and sculptures to encourage people to patronise Australian artists. His government gave lucrative commissions to artists of the Heidelberg School, which Fisher also patronised himself, hanging some of their paintings in his St Kilda mansion. Well, Fisher also planned to have an Australian coinage minted in Australia and to change the Australian flag. However, Deakin got in first and introduced coins minted in Britain and embossed with imperial rather than in Australian sentiments. And those people who know about coins will know that the old coat of arms, the pre-Fisher coat of arms, stayed on Australian coins until 1945, I think it was, before it was replaced with a new one. Well, as the, ironically though, the greatest impetus for a national spirit occurred during Fisher's last prime ministership, but it occurred in the gullies of Gallipoli, This caused Fisher to put aside his misgivings about the British management of the campaign and to embrace the fighting as a nation-building exercise. Poor Keating would not have been happy. But how could Fisher do otherwise after committing Australia to support Britain to its last man and its last shilling? As the first wounded soldiers arrived from Gallipoli, he joined with Hugh Patterson and the Victorian Artists Society to organise a pageant for Australia on 30th of July 1915, which was dubbed Australia Day, but which might more properly be called Australia's first Anzac Day. Patriotic floats were paraded through Melbourne streets with scenes from Australian history, minus the convicts and the Aborigines, and culminating in cars carrying wounded soldiers and ones with the daughters of Pierce, Fisher, that's George Pierce, the Defence Minister, Fisher and the daughter of Hugh Patterson, dressed in white and gold to represent the states, and one girl wreathed in laurel and dressed in green and gold to represent the nation. He also brought back the body of General Bridges, the Australian commander who'd been killed at Gallipoli, who was given a massive funeral in Melbourne before his remains were taken to Canberra for burial at Duntroon. So he was the only soldier brought back from the war and buried in Australia. And the film of that is still available, I think, from the war memorial. There's this little, I think it goes for about 3 minutes, of Fisher coming out of the St Paul's Cathedral in Melbourne to this huge crowd lining Swanston Street with all the soldiers, including wounded soldiers from the war. Well, it was this drive to create a sense of Australian nationhood rather than any great attachment to empire that caused Fisher to mute his opposition to Gallipoli and the senseless waste of Australian troops at the Dardanelles. While recognising the nation-building possibilities of Gallipoli and refraining from any criticism of the British, he kept saying that, well, we had criticisms, but we would keep them to ourselves until after the war. It wasn't proper to bring them out until after the war. But even after the war, he remained silent. While refraining from any criticism of the British, the disastrous campaign helped to convince Fisher in October 1915 to resign as Prime Minister and to take up the more lucrative and secure position as High Commissioner in London, where he was gradually overtaken by the dementia that would eventually kill him in 1928. Well, Fisher is a good example of someone who had layers of identity. It's the story of migration writ small, I guess, or writ large. A passionate Ayrshire Scot who ensured that his first son was born on Scottish soil, he quickly became attached to Queensland before moving to Melbourne in 1901 and becoming an ardent Australian, who nevertheless retained sufficient attachment to Britain and the Empire such that he spent the last 13 years of his life in London and chose to die there. Thank you.
Thank you, David. So, Janet Grundy outside's got... Oh, she's providing cheers. That's very nice, yeah. Janet Grundy's got copies of Andrew Fisher, Prime Minister of Australia, which has just been released by HarperCollins. And so we come to questions and discussion, finishing no later than 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. Just talk us through the final bit, the final comment you made about Fisher, because he's one of those few Prime Ministers who left at a time of his own choosing. Why do you think he chose the stand down for Hughes? You mentioned there was a prospect of greater remuneration, but there must have been other reasons than that. And because he was the High Commissioner in London, did he then have to take a stance on the issue that divided Labour over conscription, or was he able to avoid that because of his diplomatic posting?
There were really three reasons, I guess, that Fisher resigned in October 1915. He'd been undermined by Hughes for the best part of a year. Hughes kept putting rumours around that Fisher, the job in London had been open for the best part of a year. George Reed had held the job and had been given an extension and wanted a further extension. So the Reed's term had already finished and his extension was coming to an end, so there were stories about who was going to replace him, and Hughes had been diligently going around spreading rumours that Fisher actually wanted the job, and Fisher, to his great annoyance, had to try and kill these rumours. So in June, it was at the Easter show in Sydney, the Governor-General confronted him about it, you know, that he'd heard rumours that Fisher was going off to London, and Fisher got quite angry and had to say that that was not true. So he was being undermined politically. His supporters, you know, his closest supporters, Fraser in the lower house and McGregor in the upper house, had both died just prior to the war. So two of the props, political props for Fisher, had been cut away from him. He was also, one suspects, perhaps feeling the first intimations of that dementia as well. Certainly his health was being tested by the war. He was not only Prime Minister, he was also the Treasurer. And so being Treasurer in wartime was particularly trying. And for much of the winter in 1915, he spent it in his home and had to have official papers brought down to him for him to work on. So his health was being undermined, but there was also the financial reason as well. He'd just spent a lot of money buying this big mansion in St Kilda. It was a rather run-down mansion, about 50 years old, that had been let go. It had full of exotic plants, but the garden had been let go, so it was a bit of a jungle. But Fisher bought it because it had seven bedrooms, and he had six kids, plus his mother-in-law, and either two or three sisters-in-law living with him in his three-bedroom house. So he bought this house, but he insisted also that the 2 acres of ground be put in as well. That was going to be subdivided off, but he insisted on buying that as well. So he was, you know, probably up to his eyeballs in debt, even though he was quite a serious saver in trying to pay for this. And now he faced the possibility, because of Gallipoli, of paying a political price for this military disaster that he had led Australia into and not really questioned at all. He'd watched as British ministers had faced problems and lost their jobs in Britain, and the government was being embattled in Britain. And if he lost his job in Australia, you know, perhaps he could hang on as a backbencher, or perhaps even as a minister, but he would be paid a lot less and it would be very difficult for him to cope. So there was a big incentive for him to take on the job as High Commissioner, which was for a fixed term of 5 years and for a pay that, from memory, I think was three times the salary of the Prime Ministership. He was a very canny Scot, but of course it was a great tragedy. It was a great tragedy for Australia that Fisher's health wouldn't admit him carrying on, because he certainly wouldn't have gone on to divide Australia. The other issue that was pressing upon him was conscription. There was a growing movement in Australia, within the Labor Party as well as within the wider society, to introduce conscription. Unfortunately, that promise that he made, the last man and the last shilling, people in those days took politicians' promises seriously. And it was a matter of honour. It was a matter of honour for Fisher, and it was a matter of honour for Australians. You know, and there's testimony of people who said, well, you know, we promised our last man and our last shilling, so I had to go. You know? So there was pressure, though, to give Australia's last man and last shilling through conscription. And there was a feeling that too many eligible people were holding back. And in order to keep up the numbers and to provide reinforcements, they really needed conscription. And when Britain introduced conscription, that pressure increased enormously. And Fisher would not have presided over a government that introduced conscription. He was adamantly opposed to it. So the way that he dealt with that question of conscription, when Hughes put pressure on all former prime ministers to sign a statement calling on people to vote for conscription was to simply refuse to say, well, as High Commissioner, as a public servant, I can't be involved in politics, and simply stood aside from that dispute.
There's a question here. Yeah.
I recollect in Susanna de Vries' book, Blue Ribbon, Bit of Bread, that she gave credit to Samuel Griffith for stopping the use of Pacific Island Labour in the cane fields of Queensland. And I thought you suggested it was Fisher who should have the credit. And I wondered if those two things could be reconciled.
Yes. Griffith did it in the 1880s and then retracted in the 1890s. And it was Fisher who actually brought an end to it. In the early 19, when he came in 1910.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anne? For someone who grew up as a miner and ended up a migrant, he had enormous ambitions and potential to think big. Mm. I mean, even when he married, he took off for Britain and a pregnant wife with him, and they went through Northern America, she documented. I mean, what was that in him? Where did he get that from, and what made him that kind of person? Did he come from an interesting stock? Came to Australia, were quite different from the average. They had to come a long way. But he seemed to be a risk taker. He borrowed £100 to go off on that trip. I
mean, yeah.
Or was he just a homesick man?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't...
I get you to talk to the back of the room.
Yeah, he wasn't just a normal coal miner and didn't come from just normal coal miner stock. His father, after he got black lung disease and had to finish coal mining, became secretary of the local cooperative in the village. So it was a family with aspirations, and that was very common, of course, in the Scotland of that time. Self-education, people were educated in the church as well as in the school. So there was a high degree of literacy, and there was also a feeling that people owed it to their fellow Scots to immigrate. There was too much labour in Scotland, and that people should immigrate in order to deal with this labour surplus. So Fisher, he immigrated really against his will, and supposedly his mother threatened to disown him if he didn't go, which was rather curious way to put it. He also got, I think, a feeling of destiny as well, because of a sense or a firm belief that he was descended, his family was descended from William Wallace, the Scottish rebel. Whether that's true or not is probably impossible to tell. But the fact that Fisher believed it is important, I think, for understanding where he comes from. And Fisher made a point of going up to Aberdeen with his young son, because Aberdeen had just erected this huge monument, and I saw it myself earlier this year, huge monument to William Wallace. And he went up there to show his young son this monument. He wrote down in a little, scribbled down in a little notebook, the inscription on the monument about how people should refuse to live under slavish bonds, which I think that sort of Wallace, that idea of Wallace's, I think, helped to convince Fisher that he had to support the First World War, that if Germany won the war and perhaps controlled Australia, Australians would be living under slavish bonds. Of course, Curtin at the time took a very different view and opposed the war from the beginning.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not strictly on your topic, but I've always had the impression, I might be quite wrong, that the 1890s Depression was a pretty bad one and was, part of the reason for the formation of the Australian Labor Party. Am I exaggerating the importance of that Depression?
There's a question about the impact of the 1890s Depression on the formation of the Labor Party.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was really the 1880s and early 1890s with the strikes and such forth.
Yeah.
And the failure of those strikes. People thought that they could achieve what they wanted through strike action, through a general strike or whatever. And when they failed, people turned to political action instead. So it was that rather than the Depression. Depressions usually, by their name, are depressing, and they depress political activity to a large extent.
Robert Grundy?
He's described interestingly as both a coal miner and a Sunday school teacher in his time in Queensland. Did he maintain his faith, and was he active in it through his period as a coal miner? Is that something that he let slide?
He continued to be an active churchgoer. He faced the problem in Gympie of having to choose, really, between continuing to be a Sunday school teacher or being politically active. And the crisis came when he actually signed a notice for a meeting on a Sunday. And you know, there was a lot of movement within the Presbyterian Church against organising anything on Sundays. And he was called to account by the elders of his particular church, and he offered to resign as Sunday school teacher, but relented and stayed on until the end of the year, and then resigned. But he continued to attend church, and but he didn't force his children to go to church, and I think he became less involved. He had been talking at one stage of possibly being a minister in the church, but I'm not sure that that went much further than the early 1890s.
I'm wondering whether it's possible for you to paint a picture for us how the Prime Minister at that time, or a politician aspiring to become a Prime Minister at that time, was able to campaign in the absence of all the, you know, the obvious means of campaigning that we take so much for granted now. He was obviously a very activist man. He wanted to do a lot of things in a fairly short period of time, and he had to convince a lot of people of a lot of these things. So in a country like Australia, and that, you know, what does it look like? What does a campaign like that?
The question is how a politician of Curtin's generation went about campaigning.
Yeah, a lot of travel. So in that period in 1909, when I was talking about when the Parliament was closed and Deakin was trying to get Parliament to meet again, Fisher was going all around Australia by boat, by train, by horse. You know, he would ride a horse around the back blocks of Queensland. Sometimes he would ride his horse, and his fellow speaker, George Rylands from Gympie, when he was in the State Parliament, would be cycling along behind him around these, you know, rough country roads and through the mountains of Queensland. When he was Prime Minister, and, you know, people attended public meetings. You know, thousands of people would attend. And there's a picture in the book, in fact, of a meeting in Maryborough where I think there were about 2,000 people attending. I don't know how they managed to throw their voice to the back of the hall like they did. But Fisher would get up there and give this dry as dust facts and figures talk about what he'd done and how the budget was in surplus, and, you know, how he'd restored the budget from the irresponsible spending of the Conservatives, etc. And I don't know how people stayed awake, really, because, you know, you read them and, you know, it's hard to get anything really inspiring out of it. It's really like an accountant's speech rather than a Prime Minister's. But he would always take with him Gregor MacGregor. And Gregor MacGregor was... Fisher was partly deaf in one ear after being kicked by a cow as a kid. And Gregor MacGregor was almost totally blind after being hit by a branch as a man. And Gregor MacGregor, of course, had to remember everything. So he would get up, I think, before Fisher and give this brilliant speech from memory, you know, full of rhetoric, full of fiery rhetoric. And then Fisher would get up. He would warm the crowd up, and then Fisher would get up and give his really quite dry as a bone speech.
Go here, and then we go to Jeff. Yeah.
To what extent did Fisher engage and enact any kind of Aboriginal policy? And also, just a very quick question, where did he actually run the country from as Prime Minister?
Well, he ran the country from Melbourne. And in terms of Aboriginal policy, he did try and improve Aboriginal policy, the only place he could was in the Northern Territory. That's the only place he had power over Aborigines. So he did try and improve policies in the Northern Territory, but you know, it'd be difficult to point to any huge improvements. I mean, that was probably a great failure of Fisher. He had ideas that you could develop the interior of Australia. All the deserts needed was water, you know, and people to develop the farms that were possible there. And of course, they weren't. They weren't possible. He had as most Australians at the time, he had a poor understanding of Australian soils and climate.
Was there an actual office of Prime Minister? Like, there was a public house, public office, or ran it from his home in Melbourne, or?
He had an office in Collins Street. And he established a Prime Minister's department for the first time. And he was the first Prime Minister to have his own car. Alfred Deakin would cycle in from South Yarra to work, whereas Fisher ordered, after Reid as High Commissioner bought a car in London, Fisher went out and got a new Renault car for himself, complete with a chauffeur, and when he found that the headlights weren't the best headlights available, instructed that the best headlights be bought, because he thought it was demeaning, you know, that why should a Labour Prime Minister have anything less?
But there was no official residence.
No.
Jeff, and then Stuart, yeah.
You've mentioned how Billy Hughes undermined him politically towards the end in 1915. Could you just explain in a little bit more detail the relationship between Fisher and Hughes during Hughes's prime ministership?
Well, unfortunately, you know, Fisher may have had some sort of illusions that he would play a big role in London as High Commissioner, you know, that he would have the ear of the British government and that he would be able to represent Australian opinion in London. But instead, within weeks of his arrival, Hughes followed him to London and stayed there for months. So Fisher was pushed back into the shadows. You know, he was greeted, when he first arrived in London, greeted with great acclaim by the British press, and who reported his every word, and he made some quite strong speeches. But as soon as Hughes arrived, of course, Hughes took centre stage and became quite an important political figure in London in 1916. So Fisher slipped back into the shadows and was allowed to do very little by Hughes. So even the most menial thing, even important things like signing contracts for the final construction of Australia House, were given over to officials rather than allowing Fisher to do it.
No, I meant in Fisher's prime ministership from 1910 onwards, the relationship with
Hughes. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you read Hughes's biography, or the biography of Hughes, you would think that Hughes was the real power behind the throne, you know, that Hughes really ran the government. And he did run it when Fisher was away in London in 1911 and when he was away in South Africa in 1910. But when Fisher was there, Hughes quite often was not. You know, in 1910 to early 1911, I think it was, from memory, Fisher was simply absent through ill health. And there's just a great wad of letters from Hughes to Fisher saying, well, you know, I'm sick, I'm recuperating, either down at Queenscliff, or later he was up in Sydney or up on the northern beaches somewhere. I'll be back soon. I'll be back next month. And next month came, and I'll be back. Do you really need me? I can come by June. And there was about 7 or 8 months when Hughes simply wasn't around at all. So the biography of Hughes, you know, it doesn't mention that at all, really denigrates Fisher quite unfairly, because he really was, you know, quiet, reserved, but really the power in the government. You know, particularly with his hold, you know, with a Prime Minister's department now, and also running the Treasury.
Stuart. Yes. With the 1909 fusion of the Deakinite Protectionists and the Joseph Cook Free Traders, which created the Labour-non-Labour paradigm which we have to this day, one would argue that strengthened the non-Labour side of politics. Taking that into account, why was Fisher's Labour so successful at the 1910 election?
Well, he ran very hard on the idea that Deakin had betrayed him. You see, Deakin's policies were not that much different from Labor's. And for Deakin to go and throw in his lot with the Conservatives, whose policies were quite different. You know, Deakin's policies on the Navy, you know, he was in favour of an Australian Navy. But instead put all that aside. And Deakin, you know, one has to remember that he was starting to suffer from dementia at this time. You know, he was becoming forgetful and having trouble coping. But he threw over his previous support for an Australian Navy and instead pushed the idea of having, you know, a British-designed Navy, a Navy that could be used and sent around the world in tandem with the British Navy, and went out and borrowed a huge amount of money, you know, borrowed £3 million in order to establish this Navy, which was very much against the Labor policy. So there was a very clear distinction now. You know, it really helped Labor, because there was a very clear distinction now between the Liberals and Labor, whereas there hadn't been such a clear distinction before. It was more, you know, more subtle, the distinction between the two.
Up the back, yeah.
Yeah, quick one.
Okay, we'll make this probably the final
question. Commissioner in London, did he play any role in the appointment of Monash in the Anzac Corps late in the war, or was that something that was entirely his?
It was entirely Murdoch, really, rather than his. Fisher was involved, but not to any great extent. He didn't play a large part.
Just a final comment on how you see Fisher and the Labor legacy. As you know, Labor's very good at talking about its own history, but it's never spoken much about Fisher. So why do you think it was that Labor sort of forgot Fisher, which is uncharacteristic for Labor? And do you think your book's done a bit to bring him back? I see you had the Prime Minister launch it last week.
Yeah. Dennis Murphy had started to reassess Fisher, and Ross McMullen had as well in his history of the Labor Party. The reason why, though he hasn't been so central to the Labor narrative, I think partly it's because he went to London. You know, in a way, he sort of turned his back on Australia, and Australians really can't abide that too much. You know, that if you turn your back on Australia, whether you're still Australian, I guess. And as well, his association with Hughes and his association. I suppose if he'd come out very strongly against conscription rather than staying silent, that might have changed things, but he didn't. And I think the fact that there was no biography, there's no full-blown assessment of, Dennis Murphy's entry is all very good, but it's not as comprehensive, obviously, you know, in a couple of pages. It doesn't really deal with the full gamut and the vision, really, that Fisher had.
David, many thanks. Take a seat. Well, I'll be very, very brief. I think that's a terrific contribution that David Day has made with his book on Fisher. He's one of our finest historians, of course, but he's got a lot of important work. But I guess the three biographies in order of which they were written, of Curtin, Chifley, and now Fisher, has probably been the outstanding contribution. So well done today. It wasn't so long ago you were here talking about the Weather Bureau, and now it's Fisher, and next time something else scientific, I believe. But for tonight, congratulations. Hope the book goes well, and certainly it's a very important contribution. Well done. Thank you. And Janet Grundy's got some copies of Andrew Fisher outside. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.